Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you making this podcast part of your day. Make sure you subscribe if you want more and leave us some feedback. Away we go.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to The Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth.
I can talk broadcasting all day long. I love talking about what makes a good broadcast, who is a good broadcaster, who are the broadcasters you grew up listening to, what are the play-by-play calls you like, and why are they good. We've done that for over the years on this show, and part of it is, I gotta be honest with you, like, sometimes I'm left kind of shaking my head at the idea that I've got a radio show, or that I'm doing a podcast, or that I did local TV for like 12 or 13 years, because I grew up, like, as a kid in the backyard playing fictional baseball games and broadcasting them and talking about them, doing analysis, the post-game show in my head. So, yes, when you tell me, like, Dave Niehaus
and John
is your guy.
One more time set, and here comes the 2-2 pitch to Edgar Martinez. Down the fastball, swung on, hit the deep center field. Bernie Williams goes back, and it is get out the rye bread and the mustard this time, Grandma. It is a grand salami, and the Mariners lead it 10-6. I don't believe it.
He's your guy. He's not my guy. I had Hank Greenwald, Lon Simmons, Joe Starkey. A lot of Pac-12 fans over the years have, I think, grown up on our next guest, Yogi Roth, Pac-12 Network. He will be on the USC football broadcast tomorrow. He's joining us now. Yogi, who was your guy? If you had to say broadcaster you grew up listening to and loving.
A few. I grew up In a tiny town in Pennsylvania. We've talked about this many times. And for whatever reason, back then, like, a cable channel might pop up on your feed that you didn't really know was going to be there. So for me, it was Prism, if you remember that channel. And I could recite, like, the 76ers starting lineup like it was yesterday. So Dr. Jack Ramsey was the first guy I fell in love with. And then it was Bob Costas. Because I just fell in love with, like, opens to basketball games. It was like Sundays on NBC, and Bill Walt was on it, and Ahmad Rashad did the Inside Stuff pregame show, and then it became probably John Madden as I kind of started growing up a little bit more, and then it was honestly, as I got into high school and in college, it was Kirk Herbstreit, and he's the first broadcaster I met when I was a sophomore at Pitt. Dave Sins came in to do a presentation, voice of course, the Mariners. And he was at ESPN at the time. He did a lot of our Big East games. And then Herbie would come in, and I would talk to these guys, and I would recognize, like, oh, they're learning from me, and I could build a relationship with them. And I tell this to young athletes all the time, meet the broadcasters, meet the producers. And every Friday from my sophomore to senior year at Pitt, I would sit in on the production meeting with College Game Day, Herbstreit, Bob Davey, like whoever was calling the game at that time, and then meet Bo Garrett, Michael Fountain, all these producers. And these guys have become friends, mentors. So I probably have different stages, but it began with Dr. Jack Ramsey.
How do you know, in the role that you play at the Pac-12 Network, how do you know when to come in and talk, when to lay up, when to let a moment breathe, when to let the other broadcaster go? You know, there's a little bit of science, a little bit of art in that.
Yeah, and I don't know this for everybody's experience, but in mine, like, I didn't go to broadcast school. I just thought it was really cool. And like you, I was calling my own games in the backyard, right? It was Roth of the line, 1-1 to win the game. And if I missed the first, you know, end of the 1-1, it was lane violation, Roth back of the line. And I'd be talking that to myself as an 8-year-old. I could see shoveling like 3 feet of snow. My mom would say, she would tell you these stories if she was still alive, like, I would play and shoot until my fingers bled. And I love that, but I'd be calling it the whole time, right? Throwing the ball against the barn and being a shortstop and calling the game and making the plays. So anyway, that was my training. I get to be a professional broadcaster almost 20 years ago. And my first partner, and I've been so blessed, Steve Fisiak. Steve Fisiak was the Angels, the Royals, did the Pac-10 for a long time for Fox. And I didn't know what the talkback button was. I didn't know anything. I just knew football. I was saying Will Linebacker in my first broadcast, and he's like, never say that again, you know? But he taught me. We were calling UCLA Washington State. I'll never forget it. UCLA Washington State. I'm 26 calling Pac-10 football. Like, think of that for a minute. And this is 17 years ago. And it's the end of the game, and it's a tight game, and it was at the old Wazoo press box. You remember that. So you are up, like, you are on a cliff almost. And a play happens late, and he spreads his arms out. I could see it right now to basically be like, shut up. Like, I'm talking. Don't say a word. And when he finished, to let it live. And afterwards, he was like, and it was me, and it was Sam Ponder. This is our crew back in the day. This is my first year calling games. And he goes, let the pictures tell the story. And that was like just an abrupt lesson. And then I had Kevin Calabro, who you know, and then my good friend who's changed my life, and Ted Robinson. So my three partners – for the majority. I've worked a handful of games with Roxy and J.B. Long and Guy Haberman, who I love dearly. But the three main people I've worked with, I believe, like, taught me the traits. So I know when to not talk. And I think as you get older, you get a confidence in your own voice where you know you already have the headset. You're already told you're kind of the expert in the building. You don't have to prove it to anybody. They've already given you one of two headsets in the entire stadium or arena. So I think in my last decade, I've probably become more confident to say, you know what, I might have the greatest thing in the world, but don't say it. Say it on John's radio show when he has you on next time, and save it for, yes, for another platform.
I love that. Yogi Roth with us, Pac-12 Network. You're welcome here anytime. Yogi, you know, you're preparing for a spring game, USC. They will be on the field and part of their USC spring football game, noon, Pac-12 Los Angeles, Pac-12.com. You'll be there with J.B. Long. What kind of prep do you do? You were out at USC. What were you doing? Talking to them, watching? What are you doing?
Yeah, and Ashley Adamson, we got her too, the face of the Pac-12. She's going to be on the sideline for us, so we're rolling tomorrow. I look at spring football through the lens of it is the Rose Bowl. Like, I'm calling every game, and I've always had that mantra, and our producers and Michael Molinari would tell you at the bottom of my call sheet, you know, it always says the same thing, which is celebrate the game, coach the viewer, and let's go call the Rose Bowl. Because that's always been a career dream of mine, like the old school, like Rose Bowl, like when it was Big Ten, Pac-12 back in the day, I guess now. So I treat them all like that. I don't think you can pick and choose, in my humble opinion. So I'm preparing like I'm calling a real USC game in the season. And it's fun because there's no opponent. So you get to really double down. And what I've done every spring, you know, for the entirety of my career, is when you do it like that, then you can really kind of have a summer, right? And you follow the news, who do they pick up in the portal, what changes, but you're ready for the season. Like, I'll be ready to call, you know, if I happen to call an SC game next season, I'll be ready to roll, just like Utah a week ago, just like Oregon next week. So I'll go back, and if appropriate, based on scheme or coaching staff, I'll watch, you know, their last handful of games from a year ago if there's a specific player I want to study. But then it's talking to people, it's, you know, laying out your depth chart. I got to go to practice twice this week because I live in Los Angeles, interview a bunch of players after practice, interview coaches. Then you have your traditional production call. And for me, I try to get majority of my work done before I have the production call. So then I'm very specific. Like, if you get 20 minutes or 30 minutes with Lincoln Riley or Kyle Whittingham or Dan Lanning, like, I want to be razor sharp for that. And really take advantage of their time versus meander or just to only be general or big picture. So I go hard, and it's fun because it's like four weeks of you're back in the season. And I actually think it helps train my body. So when I hit the season and it's that long run, you're not like exhausted by week five. You're like, oh no, I did a little mini marathon a couple months ago. So I've got all my documents just like I would in a real game. I just printed them out at FedEx about half an hour ago. So I can't wait to get to the Cali tomorrow.
It's interesting. You hit on something there. You know, you're out observing practice. Over the years, you've been to a number of practices with coaches. How different are practices? Do they all start to look the same? Same drills, same energy, or do you get distinct differences as you bounce around?
Well, I think they're all a different art form, to be honest with you. I think in spring there's a generalization of let's go, and I'm stealing this from Coach Carroll because he would say it. The only goal in spring, and I'll probably say it in the open tomorrow, is to recapture your competitive edge. Like, and I loved that line that he would say to our teams that were winning 11, 12, 13 games every year back in the day. And it's really clear. You could see that, right? It paints a picture. How do we recapture our competitive edge? We use competitive periods. So when I'm walking onto a field in spring football, because it's different in the season. In the season, I'm trying to, like, in my brain, be like, what did they just run in the third down period so I can anticipate that in the game? How is their scout team on defense, you know, lining up against a certain look so I know how a team will defend a specific player, a specific scheme. In spring ball, I'm looking for competitive temperament. I try to get there early, and I always stay late. Who's staying late? What are they doing late? Like, Caleb Williams was, to me, notorious for being the last guy off the field, but not because he was messing around or not even because he was doing extra drills, but he was bonding with his teammates. And I watched that time and time again. I watched Miller Moss all week long, the presumptuous starter for SC. He's, you know, throwing extra with Deuce Robinson and some of their wide receivers. So I'm a big fan of kind of reading between the lines. And then in the drills, what is being said? And that's really what's fun for me, because I don't know everything about football, man. Like, I still have to learn. So the spring for me is like, oh, what did this D-line coach say in this drill? So I'm trying to get as close as I can to drills to pick up on, hey, maybe a something that I never heard before, or a drill I've never seen before. And now, as a flag football head coach here for our 9-year-old, I'm trying to add to our team's skill set here as I'm in practice. So there's a ton, man. I take it. I don't want to go to practice and just BS. I don't want to waste anybody's time, and I don't want to take advantage of that access.
Let me, as I think about USC, of course, you think about the departure of Caleb Williams. But in addition to that, it's not just the quarterback. Top two rushers from last season, Marshawn Lloyd, Austin Jones. Top two receivers, Brendan Rice, Taj Washington. They're all gone. And so how much of a reboot is this for Lincoln Riley?
Yeah, I'm calling it, and I'll say it in the broadcast tomorrow. This is a foundational year for USC. They are laying a foundation for the program. Every player you just referenced has one thing in common, right? They began their career somewhere else. And that's okay. That's how I think programs have to reboot. I think SC, when they came off a 4-8 season, it was a different roster than what Washington inherited with Kalen DeBoer coming off a 4-8 season, in my humble opinion. They had to fix it, and they went and found some quick fixes, and they got blessed with a relatively smooth schedule, right? They didn't play Oregon. They didn't play Washington that year. And they had the best player in the country. He was playing out of his mind, Caleb Williams. So they had a record-setting number of turnovers created defensively. So, like, everything hit for them. But last year, I took a bunch of slack because I picked SC to be fifth in the league. But that's kind of where they were. And I think going to practices, you kind of can notice some of those things because you just saw some natural holes that they were able to patchwork through. Whether it was luck or whether it was scheme or whether it was performance or whether it was lack of an opponent on the schedule. And last year when you saw the back half of who they had to play, you just, at least I looked at it and said, whew, that's going to be tough. When you go Notre Dame, Utah, Cal, Washington, Oregon, UCLA, it's just a challenging run for them. And now when I look at this team, I see 4 second-year receivers who came right out of high school. I see majority of offensive linemen other than one came out of high school. Like, I still think there's something to that. And then to your point, well, we need running backs. All right, add via the portal. They've done that, but they also have 3 guys that came out of high school. Quarterback, they needed a body. They got in Jaden Maiava from UNLV, but Miller Moss was a 4-star recruit, every big of a quarterback recruit as anybody else would get. He's ready for this opportunity. Defensively, they still have some things they're obviously working through with so many new faces and scheme, but I think this is a really foundational year for them as they enter the Big Ten. And I think this is the foundation that will allow Lincoln Riley to build and build and build for sustainable double-digit win seasons. Because now SC has everything. They're going to break ground on a new facility the day after the spring game. They are totally different conversation in the NIL world today than they were a year ago at this time, or even in the summer of last year heading into the season. So I really think the foundation is solid. I wouldn't predict them to go to the playoff next year. Right now, but I do think that this thing is headed in a really positive, solid, foundational direction.
Give me an idea, because UCLA, USC, Washington, Oregon all go into the Big Ten, and you're right, I feel like they're in different places. New coach at Washington, new coach who started late at UCLA. You've got Lincoln Riley starting over with you know, like five new assistant coaches, especially on the defensive side of the ball. And then meanwhile, Oregon is expecting to, I think, walk in and compete right away. What do you expect from that group of four?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think it's a little bit of different. I think that answer might change over the course of the next 10 days or so. You look at what Washington just did yesterday in the portal in terms of their offensive line. They've got to shore up and some of the holes that they have. UCLA lost a defensive lineman yesterday. I'm going to head over there tonight, actually. They had a really cool night practice. I've been there a few times this spring. I'm a big fan of Deshaun Foster. As a young coach, he's curious and open versus, you know, closed and, you know, seemingly have every answer. Like, we've seen versions of that when young guys get head coaching jobs. Like, he's amazing, man. Huge fan of him. But they're all in, you're right, they're all in different places and different stages. Whereas Oregon, I can't wait to get there next week. They're in a position to take a run at everything this year, and they should be. They got a foundation. They've recruited well now for a long time. Dan Lanning, I think, has taken this program to another level. I can't wait to watch Dylan Gabriel and Dante Moore at the quarterback spot. They're all a little different. And I think over the course of the next couple of weeks, we'll have an even different answer probably for UCLA and Washington versus, you know, if you were at Washington's practice yesterday or, you know, if you're at UCLA tonight, they're going to be different depth charts, I think, once we get to May with how they continue to, you know, either add or supplement their roster.
What's the ceiling for Jed Fish in like a year one? You're really familiar with him. You know, he's selling NFL experience, Pete Carroll, Bill Belichick at practice, Jack Del Rio. He's selling, you know, we know how it's done in the NFL. Will that translate with kids, and how good can they be in year one in the Big Ten?
I don't know. I don't think I can give an appropriate and confident answer now. Like, I like their schedule, right? I think they'll win their first two. But right now, if I had to pick, when I look at Washington State's roster and UW's roster, Washington State's done a nice job of keeping guys together, mm-hmm. right? Like, and it was they had every chance to win that game last year, right? They catch an interception and they have a huge upset, right? But I look at you get through the end of September, then they go Northwestern and Rutgers. Like, is there a world where they're 5-0 that makes sense? Yeah, I could see that, right? And then the schedule gets more challenging, right? Michigan at Iowa, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know. I know this, though. I believe this. I think that Jed Fish is one of the sharpest minds in the game. I think his teams have always been prepared. Look at the first year where they won one game. I believe, and oh God, I wish I had it in front of me because I referenced so many times the last couple of years. I think there were 8 games when they entered the fourth quarter within a score or less. 8 games, and they won one of them. Oregon was one. Right, you can remember that game. And they started 5 different quarterbacks that year. I think McLeod started the game in Eugene. So he's always going to have his guys ready to play from a scheme standpoint. And I think that's really notable. I've always felt that with NFL, guys come down from the NFL. I felt it when Dave Wonstadt came to Pitt, and really kind of ever since. I think there's something there. So I think they'll be in games pending the players they have. Depending how this thing shakes out in the portal will impact so much. But I do believe that UW now with Pat Chun there and, you know, knowing what they did last year, they have all the tools to be a playoff contender every year. Year one, I don't know. I couldn't even tell you right now, anything about that team with any confidence because, hey, I haven't seen it with my eyes. I've talked to the staff. I've got updates, but I think it's premature with how late they got the job and even where the roster sits today.
You are familiar with USC and know in the wake of the Reggie Bush stuff, whether or not that was a distraction, the sanctions, everything that happened. Arizona State's going to be dealing with some of that in the wake of Herm Edwards. Kenny Dillingham getting slapped with some recruiting sanctions and obviously Arizona State trying to build while you got guys like Jaden Rashada jumping in the portal. And what is Kenny Dillingham up against? Because, you know, you've been around that stuff and you know it from the USC time. How much of a distraction can that uncertainty be?
Yeah, how many scholarships were they dinged?
I'm going to look at this right now because the penalties today were really about recruiting windows and what they can do there. And you're right, at USC, it was a lot of scholarships, and it was 4 years of probation. They're not saying how many undisclosed scholarships reduced. It just says reduced. The reduction. So a reduction in scholarships, recruiting restrictions. How many should they be docked? Or should they even be docked anything given that they had nothing to do with Herm Edwards?
Yeah, it's such a unique conversation and super nuanced, right? SC was about 30 scholarships over 3 years. Yeah. I thought Lane did a hell of a job, to be honest with you. Like, they had a 10-win season, or a double-digit win season, and I think they finished in the top 10 one of those years. And SC, since 1980, if you took Pete Carroll out of the fray, they've had six double-digit win seasons, right? Like, I just say that to, like, offer context. I know that it's hard for fans to hear that, but it is the reality around, like, it's hard to win. I don't know. I think I'd have to wait to see what the number is to see the impact of it. Should this team be penalized for that? No, but somebody has to be penalized for that. So you do the show cause, which they have, but nobody's really penalized for that because of that.
Right.
So it's a tough conversation because, you know, you still represent this university. And so I'm trying to look at it like through a mature lens, like, look, if somebody doesn't get penalized, then everybody's going to cheat all the time.
Okay, right? I just got the number
what do you got?
From a source at ASU. They are saying that the bowl ban they took last year, the only remaining penalties will be no contact with recruits during the spring and the summer, no visits during a few weeks in the spring and the summer. They'll lose 1 to 2 scholarships this fall. That's only 1 to 2 scholarships in the coming fall. And then they don't know beyond that, but they don't expect that it's going to be a big number. So they already had been reduced a handful of scholarships, but this is part of the problem, Yogi. Like, nobody knows the penalty. Even Arizona State isn't sure of the penalty.
I mean, if it's... You said no contact in the spring or summer with recruits.
No visits, I don't know, no hosting. Yeah, yeah.
No visits, no hosting. How about, can you go on the road?
They just like, says no contact during a few weeks. No visits or hosting during a few weeks. So it's just going to kind of, yeah, I guess they're trying. Like, did they learn from USC? Because I think the penalty USC got was way too stiff for what we now know. The world we live in now, way too stiff.
Even the world we lived in then was way too stiff. I mean, like, it's been covered and covered and covered. But the biggest issue I've always had with the NCAA is that, like, different people are given different punishments, right? Like, if your daughters mess around, like, you or your wife give them punishment. Like, if it was somebody different every week, how would they ever learn? The NCAA has had different committees for as long as I could remember. And that was part of the restructuring of the NCAA, to my understanding, is let's not have a different committee for every football violation that has to do with recruiting. And that was where SC got, to me, dramatically and inappropriately impacted for what happened. And you can't say it killed the program because it was never, you know, on life support, but I think it opened up the window, and I've always felt it in the Pac-12 era. When SC, after they got impacted, it really allowed for, you know, I'll just say it like this. When I was recruiting, I can remember it like yesterday. I'd be sitting next to Pete Carroll. Garrett Green is the guy I'll reference. Google Garrett Green. I love Garrett. Garrett was a quarterback. Garrett went to Notre Dame High School here in Southern California. He was probably a 3- or 4-star recruit. He was going to UCLA. And we're watching Pete, and we have Mark Sanchez, Matt Barkley. I mean, we have a loaded quarterback room. And he goes, let's go get Garrett Green because I don't want to have to go play against him. So he was the, call it the 80th scholarship or whatever it was at 85 at the time. Well, once you get hit with the sanctions, like you can't do that, right? Like you have to be right all the time. And now all of a sudden, Garrett Green is going to UCLA or going to, in this instance, Stanford, Washington, Oregon, right? All teams that won the Pac-12 after USC got hit with sanctions, after SC had owned the league for the better part of a decade, right? 7 straight years, Pete Finn had a team that finished in the top 4 in the country. And he was there for 9. You know, it was absolute domination. And then it opened up the cracks. And granted, Jim Harbaugh and Chip Kelly and David Shaw had a lot to do with that. Chris Peterson, of course. But there was a world where it was just them. Kind of like it was just Bama for a while, just Clemson in their respective league. Just, you know, whether Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska at the different era in the Big 12 back in the day. So I think that I'd have to look more at it to say, like, what is the impact? Mm-hmm. I will say this, though, for Kenny Dillingham. his whole thing about activating the Valley is really about recruiting high school. And in this world we live in today in college football, who's getting hosed the most in recruiting? You have Brandon Huffman on enough to know it's high school players, right? Like, they're getting the short end of the stick. I mean, we had an Elite 11 quarterback last year. Elite 11 quarterback, top 20 quarterback in America, walked on to Florida State because they didn't have a scholarship for him.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that you just have to triple down on high school and just say, hey, just hang with us and just hang with us and recruit locally. And thankfully, they're in a state for them that has a lot of talent. But yeah, it's frustrating because of the fact that, you know, a few people on that staff or however it shook out chose to, during COVID-19, visit with recruits, et cetera, that is part of the presentation of the penalties. It's going to take some of the wind out of Kenny Dillingham's sail for sure, but he'll find a way. He always does.
Yogi Roth, Pac-12 Network. He's got USC spring game noon tomorrow, Pac-12 Los Angeles. He's on the Oregon spring game coming up a week from Saturday at Autzen Stadium. I'd love to get you back on next week. We'll talk more about Oregon. Yogi, thank you, man.
Okay, hey, homework for next week. I'm bringing our oldest son with me. Road trip.
Ooh.
First time we're doing it. We're going to Austin because he's never been to Austin. And I'm like, spring game Austin, me and him. That's not like, I'm not like going to be nervous about him. Like if it was like
a full season game,
you know. So I need a cool stop from Portland all the way down. I want like a waterfall or like whatever.
Okay.
You tell me
okay.
what we need to go do on the drive down. Okay.
All
can
right.
You help me out, man?
Yeah. I'll solicit from our listeners and I will send you a text that is a visitor's guide.
I love you right now. Thank you. Thank you so much.
There'll be no surfing, Yogi. There'll be no surfing, unfortunately,
okay.
for you. But we'll get you there. Yogi Roth, thank you, man.
We got a whole off-season to do that.
Yeah.
So.
Appreciate you. Later. There he goes, Yogi Roth. Good stuff from him. Anna will pop in the studio coming up at 5. I'm almost choking on my own words. Coming up at 5, Anna will be here to do the 5 at 5. Plus, we'll go to ASU. And the reporter who is all over the story, the NCAA sanctioning Arizona State, finally, after 2.5 years of investigating, leave it right here.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald Face.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald Face Truth Radio Show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald Face Truth Radio Show. Thanks for listening.